people have, in the scholarly world, have suggested Paul wrote these books, seven books, not the pseudo-Pauls. Seven of these books were written before 70 AD, sometime in the 50s. There was a Pauline, what I like to call a Herodian movement, somewhat, a pro-Roman movement that was up against a militant movement. And you've said this before on our shows. There's a combat, so to speak, going on here between two groups, the Hellenized group and the circumcision, as Paul calls them. This Pauline group is pushing a certain type of Christianity which seems to win and be able to break way, especially when the home front to the circumcision is destroyed. At this point, we have already multiple types of Christianity, which is where the fires of Rome idea, the persecution of Christians, all this stuff can really be, these are Jewish Christians that were killed, and the church takes it as their history. Now, I said all that because I know you. You have a good job at rabbit trailing into evidence, but I want to focus into some of the physical, archaeological evidence proving an early Flavian Christianity, and why is that that we're seeing these things? Take us into some of this evidence, if you will, and I'm here to listen.
If we're looking at the archaeological evidence, we should start at the beginning, at the very earliest physical evidence for Christianity that exists at all. And it exists in the early second century. There is no first century physical evidence for Christianity. We infer the existence of these different types of Christianity, including a Pauline, sort of a mid-first century Pauline Christianity from the literature that we have. But stepping away from the literature and dating, which has all kinds of problems, as you know, with dating and so forth, if we're looking at imagery and if we're looking at archaeology, we have to start with the actual first archaeology and images we have, and those are the Christian catacombs that exist in the area of Rome, Italy. And they are the oldest they can be traced back to is, say, the early second century, or at least the first decades of the second century. And the reason why we can identify them as Christian is because of their use of certain images. It is the very images that are used in those catacombs that help us to identify them as Christian. And those images consist of anchors, fish, or dolphins, depending on whether they can even be distinguished, as well as a sort of a constellation of other images, such as tridents attended by fish, and certain other images. There are good reasons for why Christians might have adopted all of those images, and those reasons are explained in Roman-era Christian literature in great detail. Why it was that anchors were adopted, why it was fish were adopted. But it makes best sense to look at it in the context of previous Jewish images and the use of Jewish coins and other images, such as the previous use of anchors. The anchor itself was first used in a religious way in a pagan context. It was the Greek-influenced Seleucids in what is today Syria. In the wake of Alexander the Great, the Greeks took over the region, of course, and they were ruled by Greek kings. And they brought Greek culture into the Middle East, including the worship of gods such as Apollo. And you can look on the island of Delos off of Greece, for example, and you can see very early examples, indeed, of anchors and dolphins and a dolphin around an anchor being associated with Apollo. And Seleucus, the general of Alexander the Great, who became the first Seleucid king, and his family adopted the image of the anchor and the dolphin twisted about the anchor in order precisely to associate them with the Greek god Apollo, who they claimed to be their legendary divine ancestor, which sort of legitimized the rule of the Seleucid rulers. And so the Seleucids specifically used the anchor with a dolphin wrapped around it as a way of invoking Apollo, the god Apollo, and to connect themselves with it. Now, when during the second century BCE, when the Jewish, there was a Jewish revolt, the Hasmonean Maccabean revolt, which is today celebrated still by Jews in the Hanukkah holiday, right? The Greek Seleucids had attacked Jerusalem and had defiled the temple, and a rebellion led by the family of the Maccabees basically pushed out the Greeks from Jerusalem, and they could rededicate, purify, and rededicate the temple to a strict monotheistic worship. That happened in the second century BCE. The Hasmonean kings, however, were still influenced, despite this anti-Greek push to get the Greek culture, the Seleucids, the Greek Syrians out of Jerusalem. They nonetheless were still affected by the culture around them, the Greek imagery around them. So the Maccabees, these Jewish kings who were anti-Greek and anti-Seleucid, themselves began to use the anchor image for political, purely political reasons. It should be noted that as Jews, of course, they were strictly forbidden from having any graven images, that is to say, depictions of the divine. Any kind of idol worship was, of course, strictly forbidden. Any kind of symbolic representation of God was strictly forbidden under the Mosaic Law. It's in the Ten Commandments. No graven images. Boom. So whenever we see Jewish coins in the era of the Hasmoneans, the Maccabees, they are not graven images. They are not symbols of the divine. The anchor does not represent God, for example. It can only represent something political for the Jewish rulers of the first and second centuries BCE. And specifically, they would remove the dolphin or the fish, because that specifically would clearly be a reminder, a way of invoking the god Apollo. According to Homer, for example, the earliest Greek writer, just about the earliest Greek writer we have, there's a story of the god Apollo turning himself into a dolphin. So the dolphin was directly associated with the god himself, and any connection of the dolphin with the anchor would have been seen as a divine image of Apollo. So on Jewish coins and in Jewish imagery, such as under the Maccabees and later the Herods, does not include the dolphin. Specifically will not include a dolphin or a fish in that image, because that would be a graven image. Most of the other images used by the Maccabees and the Herods in the first and second centuries BC were symbols related to temple worship, such as menorahs, right? Sometimes regional images, such as palm trees, pomegranates, things like that. Things of a neutral nature that would not be thought of as images of a god, which would be strictly forbidden under Jewish law. The anchor itself is not even like those temple images, however. It's not like a menorah, say, which would be at least connected to the Jewish religion. The anchor is specifically a pagan image adopted for political reasons without any real connection to Judaism at all.
Which it's safe to say at this point that we're seeing an early, not even necessary, like a proto-Christian. Well, prior to any Christianity even being on the scene, we have Jews that are hoping and expecting through prophetic prophets, so to speak, of a what seems to be a more Hasmonean or a more messianic slant. And even the Israelites themselves are back here 2 centuries BC saying, you go your way, we're going ours. And it's a family issue going back centuries that progressively evolves. And there's a team that's saying, sorry, we're with the Seleucids. We're with the anchor and the fish. We're with this Hellenized idea. And the opposite is true of the more true Torah Orthodox kind of idea, if you will.
The Hasmoneans would have regarded themselves certainly as Orthodox Jews, and they were doing their rebellion against the Greeks in order to preserve an independent Jewish culture in the face of being surrounded by an increasingly Greek, Hellenized culture around them. And so when we see certain images, for example, the concept of Messiah is certainly not rejected by the Hasmoneans. They themselves sort of regard themselves as messiahs. In Jewish literature, there had been many appearances of saviors who had come to rescue the Jewish people from foreign domination. King David himself might be seen as a Jewish messiah. Certainly the original Joshua, who conquered Canaan for the, when the children of Israel first came into the promised land, he could be seen as a Jewish messiah. The Hasmoneans themselves, in their liberation of Jerusalem from Seleucid rule, could be seen as messiahs. But when Messiah was symbolized, it was not a divine symbol, but because the Messiah was a man. So you could symbolize the Messiah without violating Mosaic law and creating a graven image. But the most typical symbol there would be a star. Hebrew prophecy said a star will come out, right, of the house of Judea. We have a lot of star imagery associated with Messiah, both in the literature and symbolically. So in Jewish practice, if they wanted to say, if the Hasmoneans want to associate themselves or the Herodians want to associate themselves with Messiah, we'll use a star. Star is the symbol for Messiah, but a very earthly Messiah, a man sent by God to rescue the Hebrew people. And we can see both stars and that, but what's harder to justify is, say, the anchor, which clearly has a foreign Greek Seleucid influence. If the Hasmoneans are using it, it's not because they're opening themselves up necessarily to Greek religion or culture. It's because it was simply a political unifier at the time. It was a political symbol for Jews in the first, second century BC, in the first century BC, in the first century of the Common Era. It had no real religious significance in Hebrew literature or ideology.
With that being said, I think this asks a pertinent question. You know, with this whole, what seems to be an Edomite, early, very Jewish religion, because we're fast-forwarding a little here to the New Testament, in light of this, Paul comes on, and it's been your case this entire time, and other scholars' cases. Paul is doing something, obviously, radically different. Radically. And he is saying, look, this circumcision, this dietary law, this Sabbath observance, guys, don't worry about it. And to me, that should say, and this is just my speculation without rabbit trailing, that should say your audience. That should tell you who your audience is. But nonetheless, regardless of who your audience is here, okay, however you want to interpret that, okay, what that did is opened up a door for a new movement that I personally, especially when he's right in the house of Caesar saying greetings and thank you and tell all these people and royalty, and he's meeting Agrippa and these Herods and these Caesar, these Greco-Roman people, it seems to me he's adopting their ways, which would make sense why if a movement like Paul succeeded, right off the bat we're seeing people adopt the Roman concept of the fish and the anchor. And I want to get into the fish and the anchor a little, because we've had a recent critic who espoused his opinion. There was no mutual conversation, however, which is, I really wish dialogue without emotional opinions or emotional, instead it became more like, all right, I'm just telling you and you're wrong. That's it. And so what, and then not on your part, but on the other person's part. And so they didn't know the difference between a dolphin being a mammal versus a fish at that time. But tell us about that, because he tried to say dolphin anchors were adopted by Christians in the 4th century, and he said he went to Bart Ehrman. And Bart Ehrman is kind of like, I'm willing to learn, according to him, even though we never saw any snapshots of it. It's supposedly in his blogs that you have to pay to go and see. Can you deal with that subject a little bit and explain what's going on here? Why are these guys missing this valuable piece in archaeology and coins and all that right there into the first century?
Found interesting is that they are perfectly willing to concede that anchors associated with fish were used as a Christian symbol, because that's impossible to deny. In the second and third centuries, long before Constantine, it is obvious that anchors with two fish flanking them, anchors with a fish around them. There's just a plethora of images. That image simply cannot be denied. It's so common. It's not as though any one or two images of that tell us that that was a Christian symbol. It was the Christian symbol. Fish, anchor, or fish with anchor. Now, to say that that wasn't the same image, the dolphin around the anchor image, is a stretch in my view. Why would they use fish at all around a dolphin? It is the same image. Now, it is true that they were more creative in developing it, because in Christian literature, obviously, fish plays a big role. The fishers of men, the miracle of the fish, and so forth. Just ichthys being a name, a letter game that associates itself with Jesus himself, right? In the catacombs, one of our very earliest depictions of the Eucharist, the Mass, includes not just the bread and the wine, but a fish there. So a fish becomes very important as a symbol because of Christian literature and ideology. And what we see in the Christian adaptation of the dolphin and anchor image is the use of fish specifically. Now, you're right. To the ancients, there was, you know, Aristotle understood the difference. Aristotle knew because he was a careful observational biologist. But otherwise, ancients really believed that there was no difference between fish and dolphins. The dolphin was the king of the fish. To the ancients, there wasn't this distinction that we have between dolphins and fish. And very frequently in these earliest images, you can't even tell the difference whether it's meant to be a fish or meant to be a dolphin. It's actually hard to distinguish. But all that is really beside the point. We have such a plethora of images, and the image is so closely connected, a fish and a dolphin, or two fish and a dolphin, and an anchor, just associating fish with anchors itself is obviously invoking the very same image. There can be really little doubt. I mean, if a fish with a dolphin wrapped around it, or a fish attended by dolphins, is a pagan image, and we know that, for example, in 79 AD, in Pompeii, we had, in a purely pagan context, during the Flavian era, and during the first year, you know, the explosion of Vesuvius happened in the first year of the reign of Titus, the second Flavian emperor. And we see recent art, that is to say Flavian era art, that has been found under the ash of Pompeii, which shows an anchor. And in each of the quarters, we have either fish or dolphins separated from the anchor, and then the depictions of human beings in two of the other quadrants. So fish or dolphins are being compared to people even attending an anchor. So the comparison of the aquatic life to the person, not just to the god, when it's not wrapped around the anchor, is already a pagan symbol. So just merely having an anchor flanked by two fish evokes this pagan Flavian image. So in my mind, it's impossible to separate out the connection of anchors and fish or dolphins, whichever it is, whether it's fish or dolphins, the two images are really the same. So closely related that no contemporary would have not seen the difference. To make a big difference between fish and dolphins at this stage is not, I think, consistent with the ancient mentality in the first place. They wouldn't have made a huge distinction. And in any event, what we're seeing is clearly a Christian adaptation of this pagan image. It is true that Paul was separating us ideologically, probably by the mid-first century, from the Mosaic Law. He said you could be a worshiper of the Jewish God and a good member of the house of Israel without having to be circumcised, without having to worry about kosher diet and not eating with Gentiles. And while he doesn't himself specifically address graven images as another exception to the Mosaic Law that Christians could get away with, it would clearly be another exception. And when, of course, Paul opened up his mission to Gentiles, by the end of the first century, beginning of the second century, must have a lot of Gentile converts. That is to say, people who were comfortable with graven images. The question still remains, even though Pauline Christianity says we can loosen up on the Mosaic Law, not need to worry about graven images so much, even though we now have a bunch of Gentile converts into Christianity by the beginning of the second century, this question still has to arise: why did they use anchors and fish at all as their religious symbol? And in doing so, what they're doing is they're picking up on the anchor, which was used for purely political reasons by previous Jewish kings. Purely political reasons by Jewish kings, is making a political statement, saying we can get along with the pagan world, in effect.
I like where you're taking this, James. I really do, because I've been looking at the New Testament myself recently, and just, you know, I kind of tell my journey. You know, I share my journey. I'm very transparent. I may be wrong. That's okay. You know, honestly, like, that's okay.
Honestly, that's what makes you a hero, is that you're open-minded and are willing to go where the facts are.
Well, thank you.
Your journey is a heroic one, my brother.
I do want to say this pertaining to this topic here. I've been looking at this, trying to understand a natural explanation for why the text and the things say they do. I used to look at this thing and go, oh, supernatural. Now I'm looking at it going, what's the motivating factor here? And when you start to consider these things and you look at them, from my perception, it appears it's not just political. It is very, I don't know if Rome separated their politics from this the gods have our back thing, because Piscean Age is what we're seeing with the fish here. And the Jews thought they were going to rule the Piscean Age and that the Messiah would come and bring them in. And sure enough, the Son of Man takes care of that business, which we see as Titus, at least given that context of that location. To be fair, we know that the temple's destruction being led by the Son of Man is definitely, I mean, I don't know how you can separate it from Vespasian, Titus, the Flavians, from what they connect to Josephus, clearly indicating they're the Messiah in this situation. I think the New Testament authors indicate that, which should connect us to this political machine you're talking about and kind of tell you, well, dang, I'm not going to dispute the dating. Or when do you want to date these books? I don't care. But whenever you date these books, you need to go ahead and apply what James Vine is saying here about that fish, the anchor, and the evolution of this political machine. It's adopted into the text. So if you take Paul all the way back into the 50s, I suggest there's already at least the very beginning stages of this thing we're seeing, you're talking about here, and it evolves into the mastermind of what we see later.
If we do accept the standard scholarly breakdown of Paul and the pseudo-Paul, right, those seven letters that are generally regarded as the authentic Paul, Romans, Galatians, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, Philippians, right, those are the hardcore Paul, then it is a curious thing that Paul doesn't mention fish. They're all over the Gospels. Given their descriptions of the destruction of the temple, given their obsession with the temple, scholars have said are 70 or after the destruction of the temple. So it's interesting that fish don't become even an important image in the literature until after 70. And when we begin to see the use of the fish in association with the anchor in the very first catacombs, we also see it associated with other pagan symbols used by the Flavians, such as a trident. Or trident attended by two fish, as if to really drive the point home. Here is a Christian symbol. We've got two fish, just like the two fish flanking an anchor, but this time they're flanking a trident, a symbol of Poseidon or Neptune, which is also a Flavian used image. So these are pagan images and a constellation of pagan images that are the very first pagan images that are being used in the very first Christian catacombs. So our very first physical evidence of Christianity really comprises a constellation of images that were used by the Flavians specifically. So when the Seleucids use the anchor, they're using it associated with a dolphin. For Christians to use it associated with a fish in any way is clearly to use the same image and to use it in a religious way, in a way that Jews had not yet done. Now, politics and religion. It is impossible 2,000 years ago to cleanly separate those two issues out. For us today in the modern world, especially in the West, where we have a separation of religion and law, what we call in America the separation between church and state, where we say, look, law should apply to everybody equally, whatever their religious beliefs, and there's, you know, an independent moral basis other than a specific, you know, sectarian religion for our secular laws against murder and so forth. We in our modern minds have a clear separation between religion-based law, say, and secular government. In the ancient world, that distinction did not exist at all. There was no separation between religion and politics. Religion was a necessary part of justifying your political position. And your political position was always a reflection of deeper religious considerations. And so, for example, just take the pagan Roman world. They deified their emperors. They deified their state gods. Part of being a good, loyal Roman citizen was to genuflect to Roman state gods, to respect the deification, say, of a Roman emperor, which is a problem for Jews, right? Strict monotheistic Jews who can't engage in any kind of idol worship, whatever. And allegedly was a problem for Christians in the second and third centuries as well, right? And to what extent is more complex. The Jewish rebels were motivated in their rebellion against Rome for religious purposes. There was no reason for them not to have been happy members of the Roman Empire, just as everyone else was, or at least to the extent that everyone else was. The Greeks and the Egyptians may not have liked Roman domination, but they could become members of the wider Roman society without the same kind of religious problems that the Hebrews had with it. The Jews believed that the strict adherence to Torah, to the law of Moses, required their own political independence. They regarded foreign influence as a corruption. For example, just Roman coins with the images of Roman gods or emperors on them were graven images in violation of the Mosaic law. Merely touching such a thing would be to touch an idol and would be a form of pollution or uncleanliness. Explaining the money changers at the temple, why you couldn't buy your sacrifice, your Passover lamb with, you know, this pagan money. You had to go to the money changer, exchange it for more pure money that didn't have these graven images on it, just to purchase your Passover lamb for sacrifice, right? And that explains the whole money changers thing and why Jesus got all upset with them, you know, calling them thieves. So there's a close and intimate relationship between politics and religion in these days, both on the Roman side and on the Jewish side, that's motivating both sides. It's motivating both sides. So when Paul comes out of the chute, say in Romans 13, saying we have to obey the state as God's agents on earth, and that rebellion is a sin, for example, in one of those original seven Pauline, true Pauline epistles, then we're seeing a political statement being made on top of his anti-Torah religious statement. On top of his anti-Torah religious statement. So we are seeing a blend of politics, political and religious motivations on both sides. What Paul is trying to do is craft a way to be a good Jew, a worshiper of the Jewish God, while still being a good Roman, while still obeying the Roman state. And to do that, he understood that we have to kind of loosen up on our strict adherence to the Mosaic law. We've got to be able to eat with Gentiles, for example. We've got to, you know, loosen up on the idea of circumcision. Uncircumcised rulers might not be such a bad thing. Associating with the uncircumcised may not be itself a kind of pollution, much less eating with Gentiles be a kind of pollution. Touching their money, you see, is also right there, just as Jesus does in the Gospels. When Jesus is asked whether it's okay to pay the Roman tax, show me the money, and he actually touches the money as if to prove that handling Roman money with an image of Caesar on it specifically. Whose image is on this? Jesus says, Caesar. Ah, well, that makes it a graven image. Pollution as far as first century Jews are concerned. And Jesus handles it, you know, in violation of that prohibition against idol worship. And so we begin to see that Caesar images are okay with Jesus, certainly by the time of the Gospels. Right? There is both a simultaneously a political and religious message to all of this going on. And Paul is trying to carve a way to be a good Jew and not a strict adherent to the Mosaic law. And by the time you get to the Gospels, they're directly taking on living in the Roman world and handling Roman money. And that's why it makes perfect sense that images that might be associated with Caesar could be the earliest images we see associated with Christianity in the catacombs. That still does not explain why it's the very same image. The same image used by Seleucids, the same image used by Flavians. We have to remember that when Titus becomes emperor, and he was the Roman emperor who not only claimed to be a Jewish Messiah, but who sacked Jerusalem in fulfillment of Jesus' prophecy in the Synoptic Gospels. Jesus very clearly predicts the destruction of the temple, and in terms so detailed that scholars have recognized that the Synoptic Gospels get that description at or after the event, the destruction at or after 70 AD. And by the time Titus becomes emperor around 79 AD, he is clearly now using the Seleucid image of the fish, the dolphin specifically, wrapped around an anchor. And he issued this image in the thousands. There are several different coin types that use this very image, with Titus's image on one side of the coin and with the anchor and dolphin image on the other side of the coin. And it was only used briefly after his death by his brother Domitian, who succeeded him as emperor, who quickly discontinued it, and then again briefly during the second Jewish revolt in the Emperor Hadrian's time in the second century. And that was only used briefly. So it's interesting that Roman emperors only used it when they themselves were associating or trying to associate themselves with the handling of the Jewish rebellion. Very, very interestingly. Mm-hmm. So just as the very moment when Christians are first adopting anchors and fish as their first symbols, and I don't care whether you call them dolphins or fish, it really is irrelevant. It's the same image and would have clearly been the same image in the minds of second century Romans. You've got in your pocket, you've got jingling around, you know, several different kinds of coins that have Titus on one side and a symbol of Apollo or a symbol of Jesus, depending on how you want to look at it, the dolphin and anchor on the other side. On the other side. So here is clearly a pagan graven image picked up from pagans with no particular association to Judaism, whatever, that's being picked up by Christians as their first symbol, just as the Roman coins are still jingling in their pockets with the very same set of images.
This is fascinating, James. You've got so many questions come up, you know, in good ways of like trying to figure out what, I mean, it's obvious to me what Paul's doing, you know, the whole idol thing, right? Let's take a moment here, and I know this is not directly into that, but Paul's talking about meat sacrificed to demons, okay? Or another way of putting it, to idols, really. He's literally equating these demons to this their imagination. They're all BS. It's not real. So why sweat it, right? Like, it's not like these demons are real. There's only one God who's, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's very interesting kind of, I guess, angle where Paul's going at this. He's kind of like saying, guys, it seems progressive where he's saying, hey, these idols aren't that big of a deal. And I could easily see him saying, don't sweat these coins. Ken Humphrey was recently on here, as well as other scholars, and they said simply, now these are mythicists, but at the same time, I think we all agree on this. This is a syncretism machine. And I love how you avoid the question of whether there was a Jesus or Paul. You just stick with scholarship and you say, it doesn't matter on these questions. You have avoided the controversy altogether.
I personally, it's crazy because someday, you know, I'll read mythicists and on those days I'll think, okay, there probably wasn't a Jesus. And then sometimes I'll read at least conservative historicists and I'll say, oh, they've convinced me Jesus was a political rebel. He was some kind of revolutionary. And so frankly, it reflects my own opinion, which is, I don't know. If there was a Jesus, a historical Jesus, I'm pretty sure he wasn't a peace-loving, you know, moralistic philosopher in the hills of Galilee spreading the word of peace and it's okay to pay your taxes. That is unlikely in my view. If there was a Jesus, the one thing that is probably true about him is that he was crucified. And if he was crucified, he wasn't crucified for saying, render unto Caesar and blessed are the peacemakers and befriending tax collectors, right? He was crucified for being a political rebel. Crucified for being a political rebel. I think we have to locate a lot of the original ideas in the New Testament to Paul as our original source, Saul or whoever he was, as opposed to Jesus, because Paul himself, for example, in Galatians, is having strenuous arguments with the previous apostles, right? All the previous apostles, those who tradition says actually knew Jesus or maybe were related to Jesus, they're all wrong. I'm right. And if you're listening to James and Kephas, you're screwed up. You got to listen to me about things like circumcision and eating with Gentiles, as he strenuously argues in Galatians. One of his constant themes in Galatians and Corinthians is we are free in Christ now from the Mosaic law, right? And we can loosen up on all that. And if you listen even to the later traditions about Paul in the book of Acts, there's Paul going into Athens and pointing to statues of the unknown God and saying, maybe this is, you know, our unknown God they're already acknowledging. With what? A statue, a graven image, a pagan image of a God, which would be an affront, anathema to a Jew of the first century. Any kind of image like that, that Paul is saying, hey, this Greek statue of the unknown God, hey, that could be an acknowledgement of our unknown God, the God of all, right? Wow, what a curious thing to associate Paul with at all. There is no question that there is a political implication to Paul's attack on the Mosaic law, his assertion that we have to obey the state in Romans 13. Romans chapter 13. There's clearly a political overlay to both his attack on the Mosaic law and his insistence that we obey the Roman state and not rebel, like the Jewish rebels of his time, if he was living in the mid-first century, were actually doing. Which opens up the whole broader question, why would they have adopted this very symbol? Any kind of aquatic animal at all, whether it's fish or dolphins, in association with anchors. It was used by Titus, and that was the most recent use that Christians in the early second century would have been aware of. They would have been so aware of it from literally thousands and thousands of such images on Titus coins that the connection would never have been lost in the early second century mind. They knew precisely what they were doing. The anchor was so closely associated with the Flavians, with Titus, that the way we even identify the earliest catacomb, the very first Christian archaeology, the catacombs of Domitilla, as either being both Flavian and Christian, are for the same reason, the use of the anchor. The use of the anchor clearly tells us this is the Flavian sepulcher, where Flavians are buried. We got an anchor. It also begins to tell us this is where the anchor comes from as a Christian symbol. There'd be nothing but a political reason to use anchors at all by early Christians, much less anchors associated with sea creatures. But that was already being used as a Flavian image in a pagan context back in 79 AD as the ruins from Pompeii show. The Christians could have adopted altogether different imagery altogether, even if they'd wanted to adopt such a symbol. Why didn't, for example, the cross? Why wasn't it always just the cross? Just a cross. No, we have to have the cross itself turned into an anchor, and that's the way early Catholics looked at it. Well, maybe the anchor was sort of a disguised form of the cross. And it's true, some anchors have a cross, you know, a cruciform top to them, but not all of them do. Some Christian anchors don't have that cross imagery at all. And in fact, crosses were not used in the second and third century by second and third century Christians nearly as much as anchors were. Anchors attended by fish. It's fish or dolphins, if we can even distinguish the two, associated with anchors that are far more commonly used by Christians before Constantine than crosses ever were. Why not pick a whole different symbol? Why not stick with the Jewish symbol of a star, for example? They could use stars and crosses.
That tells me that there's a separation in movements, obvious, a very distinct one. In the catacombs, though, because that's the earliest known archaeological Christian evidence that we have that directly connects us to not only some type of Roman, no, the royalty of Rome, the literal, it's like, here's the president, okay, and you want to know what they're attached to. Well, the royalty of Rome here, you have this catacombs. What is archaeologically found in this place? I mean, what is there that's going on? And we could put images on the screen showing you guys. What are we finding here that ties us to Christianity?
And that's really the interesting question. It's only because of the continuous tradition that leads to the direct... And see, our critics who say, well, dolphins were adopted in association with anchors, and we can clearly see that when the art starts getting clear and good in the time of Constantine. And it's true that the quality of Christian art and just goes way up with Constantine. There are some good images before, but after Constantine and it becomes the official religion of the empire, now the artistic quality goes up and we can really distinguish between dolphins and fish anyway. But why would Constantine's time adopt the dolphin as if it was just a reference to this continuous tradition? The same reason why anchors and fish had been used for the previous 200 years. There's no reason to return to a more Titus or a more Apollo or a more Seleucid pagan type image there. No, it simply reflects the fact that the dolphin was the image that they had been continuously using, whether it was fish or dolphins. The entire time Christians had been using the same image. That use of dolphins in the after Constantine in the fourth century was itself a reflection of the fact that this is simply a continuation of the same tradition.
You bring up a very good point. And not only the tradition of these archaeological, you know, let's give our symbols being passed. I mean, because that's really what's up for dispute amongst all these people with what you're claiming. They don't deny that there's earlier manuscript tradition that's being, so they're taking this earlier manuscript tradition and they're saying, well, we're still using that. What, and now they're just going to now recreate a totally new version of symbolism? No, I mean, that makes good sense.
Should Christians even be citing Seleucus as the source? And they specifically cite, mind you, more than one Christian actually it seems to understand in this pre-Constantine period, Clement of Alexandria in particular, understands in particular that the anchor and the right, even the he would offer doves and lyres and other symbols that are associated with Apollo. And he specifically cites Seleucus, who was the Flavian's precedent for all this. Why should this pagan tradition be the one picked? Now, it is true that Jews picked up on Seleucid imagery, but for non-religious purposes, to put them in association with fish at all is specifically to clearly associate it with the pagan uses by the Seleucids some hundreds of years earlier, which would be a bizarre thing. Why would something hundreds of years earlier be relevant? I think what he's trying to do is find a non-Flavian connection for it at this point, even though what's interesting is that Clement of Alexandria's own name is Titus Flavius Clemens. He himself may well be a Flavian, aware of the proximate cause of the connection. But as I say, it's a whole constellation of images used by Flavians, such as tridents and fish, clearly pagan images, clearly images used by Flavians. And the most recent use by, it's so funny, the catacombs of Domitilla herself appear to be the catacombs of a Flavian imperial woman herself, Domitilla, the granddaughter of Vespasian, the niece of Titus, if not even further relative, if we believe Eusebius. But in any event, it is a Flavian catacomb itself. And so again, we can't miss the connection between the Flavian use of fish and dolphins on Titus coins and the Flavian use in the Flavian catacomb of St. Domitilla, which uses the exact same images, and those become the images that Christians use for the next two or three centuries, in preference, mind you, to crosses. Why? In preference, mind you, to stars, which had been the previous symbol of Messiah. Why? It's actually a constellation of familiar images, Flavian images, pagan images, graven images, but those associated for political reasons with the Flavians and before that with the Seleucids, who were actually Greeks fighting. See, it would make sense to Paulines in one sense, and I can understand the argument that some make. Wouldn't Pauline Christians be sympathetic to, say, opening up to Gentile images, Seleucid images? That's not a sufficient explanation in my mind. They had a whole menu of images they could have chosen from, even if they wanted to choose from pagan images. They specifically used the ones that were designed to politically integrate with the wider Greek culture around them, or in the case of the Flavians, to demonstrate the Flavian title to Messiah.
Wow, and wow, and wow. James, thank you so much for joining me on this show.